father replied, "It would please me and my son to visit your country and see your people, to visit your colleges and your places of music and art, your great fields, your wonderful forest of timber. And after we have had this pleasurable privilege, we would like to try to return to our home on the outside surface of the earth. This son is my only child, and my good wife would be weary awaiting our return. I fear you can never return," replied the high priest, "because the way is most hazardous, dear one. However, you shall visit the different countries in our kingdom with the appointed guides as your escort, and you will be accorded ever courtesy and kindness. Whenever you are ready to attempt a return voyage, I assure you that your boat, which is here on exhibition, shall be put in the waters of the river Hidekel at its mouth, and we will bid you Yahweh speed." Oh my. Thus terminated our only interview with a high priest, or the ruler of a continent. So we began to tour, and we began to learn about the customs. We learned that the males do not marry before they are from 75 to 100 years old, and that the age of which the women enter wedlock is only a little less, and that both men and women frequently live to be 600 to 800 years old, and in some instances, much older. Now, in the book of Josephus, it says that Yahweh prolonged the life of the patriarchs that preceded the deluge, both on account of their virtues and to give them the opportunity of perfecting the science of geometry and astronomy, which they had discovered, which would have not been done if they had not lived the 600 years for the long astrological cycles. And because it was only after the lapse of 600 years that the great year is accomplished. That's the book of Josephus. Now, during the following year, we visited many villages, said Olaf, and towns. Prominent among these being are the cities of Naga, Delphi, Heptia, and my father was called up on no less than a half a dozen times to go over the maps which had been made from the rough sketches that he had originally given of the divisions of land and water on the outside surface of the earth. I remember hearing my father remark that the giant race of people in the land of the Smoky God had almost as accurate of an ideal of the geography of the outside surface of the earth as they had the average college professor in Stockholm. In our travels, we came to a forest of gigantic trees near the city of Delphi. Had the Bible said that there were trees towering over 300 feet in height and more than 30 feet in diameter growing in the Garden of Eden? The Ingersolls, the Tom Paines, and the Voltaires would doubtless have pronounced the statement as only a mere myth. Yet this is the description of California Sequoia. But these California giants pale insignificantly to compare with a forest that these Goliaths have in the inter-within continent, where abound mighty trees from 800 to 1,000 feet in height. Listen to that now. 800 to 1,000 feet. And from 100 to 125 feet in diameter. Countless in numbers. And forming forests extended hundreds of miles back from the sea. The people are exceedingly musical. They have learned to be in a remarkable degree in their arts and science, especially geometry and astronomy. Their cities are equipped with vast palaces of music, where not infrequently as many as 25,000 lusty voices of this giant race form choirs that swell forth in mighty courses of the most sublime sympathies. And the children are not supposed to attend colleges or institutions of learning before they are 20 years old. Then their school life begins and continues for 30 years, 10 of which are uniformly devoted by both sexes to the study of music, which seems to be very important in their culture. Their principal vocations are architecture, agriculture, horticulture, the raising of vast herds of cattle, and the building of conveyances peculiar to that country for travel on land and water by some device which I have no idea and cannot explain. They hold communion with one another between the most distant parts of their country on air currents. Our buildings are erected with special regard to strength, durability, beauty, and symmetry, and with a style of architecture vastly more attractive to the eye than any that I have ever observed elsewhere. About 3/4 of the inner surface of the earth is land, and about 1/4 is water. There are numerous rivers of tremendous size, some flowing in a northerly direction, and others go southerly. And some of these rivers are 30 miles in width, and it is out of these vast waterways at the extreme northern and southern parts of the inside surface of the earth, in regions where low temperatures are experienced, that freshwater icebergs are formed. And ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to wonder about the freshwater icebergs in a salty ocean, question is, wonder where it came from. They are then pushed out to sea like huge tongues of ice by the abnormal freshets of turbulent waters that twice every year sweep everything before them. Now, the innumerable specimens of bird life, which no longer some of these that are encountered in the forests of Europe or America or in the rainforest, we know to become extinct. It is well known that during the last few years, whole species of birds have vanished from the earth. And a writer in a recent article on the subject says that almost every year, it sees the final extinction of one or more bird species. Out of 14 varieties of birds found a century since on a single island, the West Indian island of St. Thomas, 8 now are to be numbered among the missing. It is not possible that these disappearing birds quit their habitation without finding an asylum as they moved in migration to north, to the inner world. Whether inward, inland, among the mountains, or among the seashores, we found bird life prolific. When they spread their great wings, some of these birds appeared to measure 30 feet from tip to tip. They have great variety and many colors. We were permitted to climb up to the edge of a rock ledge and examine a nest of eggs. There were 5 generally in the nest, each of which was at least 2 feet in length and 15 inches in diameter. After we had been in the city of Hecta about a week, Professor Gradia, our guide, took us to an inlet where we saw thousands of turtles along the sandy shore. I hesitate to state the size of these great creatures as me to believe. But they were from 25 to 30 feet in length, from 15 to 20 feet in width, and 47 feet in height. And when they projected their head, they had the appearance of some hideous sea monster. And they were, in a sense, somewhat frightening. The strange conditions within seemed favorable, not only to vast meadows of luxuriant grasses, forests of giant trees, and all manner of vegetable life, but wonderful animal life as well. One day, my dad and I were permitted to see a great herd of elephants. There must have been 500 of these in this herd. They were thunder-throated monsters, with their restlessly waving trunks, just like on Earth, only these would dwarf the ones on Earth. They were tying huge tree limbs from the trees and trampling smaller growth into dust like so much hazel brush. And they would average over 100 feet in length and from 75 to 85 feet in height. They were unbelievably large. It seemed, as I gazed upon this wonderful herd of giant elephants, that I was again living in the public library at Stockholm, where I had spent much time studying the wonders of the age. I was filled with mute astonishment, and my father was speechless with awe. He held my arm with a protecting grip, as if fearful harm would overtake us. We were two atoms in this great forest, and fortunately, unobserved by the vast herd of elephants as they drifted on their way, following a leader as does a herd of sheep. They browsed from growing herbage, which they encountered as they traveled. And now and again, they shook the firmament with their deep bellowing. There is a hazy mist that goes up from the land each evening and invariably rains once every 24 hours. This great moisture and invigorating electrical light and warmth account perhaps for the luxuriant vegetation, while the highly charged electrical air and the evenness of climatic conditions may have much to do with the giant growth and longevity of both of the humans and the animal life that is within the earth. I was amazed. I was dumbfounded. I was struck with awe at this place called the inner earth. In places, the level valley stretched away for many miles in every direction. The smoky god, as we learned to call it, in his clear white light, looked calmly down. There was an intoxication in the electrically supercharged air that fanned the cheek as softly as a vanishing whisper. Nature chanted as it was a lullaby in the faint murmur of the winds whose breath was sweet with the fragrance of bud and blossom. Oh, what a heaven. Truly, I was astounded. Was this really what the Bible described as the Garden of Eden? Why were these left inside? If it's true that man was expelled out of the garden, was the garden a place that is now protected by the north and south poles and yet has an opening? As the Bible would describe, straight is a way and narrow is a gate and a few there be to find it? Why was we privileged to have this opportunity and yet we were so far from home? And after having spent considerably more than a year in visiting several of the many cities of the within world and a great deal of intervening countryside, and more than 2 years had passed from the time that we had been picked up by the great excursion ship on the river, that we decided to cast our fortunes once again upon the sea and endeavor to regain the outside surface of the world and return to our home, because we missed our loved ones. We made known our wishes, and our hosts were reluctant but promptly followed our host. They gave my father, at his request, various maps showing the entire inside surface of the earth, its cities, its oceans, its seas, its rivers, its gulfs, its bays, its forests. They also generously offered to give us all the bags of gold nuggets that we desired. Some of them was as large as a goose egg that we were willing to attempt to take with us in our little fishing boat. In due time, we returned to the city of Yahoo, at which palace, or which place, we spent 1 month in fixing up and overhauling our little fishing sloop, loading supplies, and after all was in readiness, the same ship, Naz, that originally discovered us, took us on board and sailed to the mouth of the river, Hideco. After Giant Brothers had launched our little craft for us, they were most cordially, regretfully at parting, and evinced much solicitude for our safety. My father swore by the gods of Odin and Thor that we would surely return again within a year or two and pay them another visit. And thus we bade them adieu, and we made ready and hoisted our sail. But there was no breeze. We were becalmed within an hour after our giant friends had left us and started on their return trip. The winds were constantly blowing south. That is, they were blowing from northern openings of the earth toward which we know to be the South Pole, but which, according to our compass pointing finger, was pointing directly north. For 3 days, we tried to sail and to beat against the wind, but to no avail. Whereupon my father said, "My son, to return by the same route as we came in is impossible at this time of year. I wonder why that I did not think of this before. We have been here for almost 2.5 years. Therefore, this is the season when the sun is beginning to shine in at the southern opening of the earth. The long cold night is on the Spitzbergen country." "What shall we do?" I inquired of my father, quite puzzled. "There's only one thing to do, son," my father replied, "and that is to go by the south gate." Accordingly, he turned the craft about, gave it full reef, and started by the compass north, but in fact, it was going directly south. The wind was strong, and we seemed to have struck a current that was running with remarkable swiftness in the same direction. In just 40 days, we arrived at the city of Delphi, a city that we had visited in company with our guides, and near the mouth of the Gihon. Here we stopped for 2 days, and we were treated most hospitably, and we entertained by the same people who had welcomed us on our former visit. We laid in some additional provisions and again set sail, following the needle due north. On our outward trip, we came through a narrow channel, which appeared to be a separating body of water between two considerable bodies of land. There was a beautiful beach to our right, and we decided to cast anchor and waited ashore to rest up for a day before continuing the outward hazardous undertaking. We built a fire, threw on some sticks of dry driftwood. While my father was walking along the shore, I prepared a tempting meal from our supplies that we had been provided. There was a mild, luminous light, which my father said resulted from the sun shining in from the south appendage of the earth. That night we slept so soundly and awakened the next morning as refreshed as if we'd have been on our own beds at Stockholm. After a hearty breakfast, we started out on an inland tour of discovery, but had not gone far when we sighted some birds which we recognized at once as belonging to the penguin family. They are flightless birds, but excellent swimmers, and tremendous in size, with white breast, short wings, black head, and long peaked bills. They stand fully 9 feet. I had never seen such a large penguin. They looked at us with little surprise, and presently waded rather than walked toward the water and swam away in a northern direction. The nights are never so dark at the poles as in other regions, for the moon and stars seem to possess twice as much light. And in addition, there is a continuous light, the varied shades that play, of which are amongst the strangest phenomenon of nature, which is the northern lights. The events that occurred during the following 100 or more days are a beggar of description. We were on an open and iceless sea. The month we reckoned to be November, or the month we reckoned to be November or December. And we knew that the so-called South Pole was turned toward the sun. Therefore, when passing out and away from the internal electrical light of the smoky god and its gentle warmth, we would be met by the light and warmth of the sun shining in through the south opening of the earth. We were not mistaken. The fact that gives the phenomenon of the polar aurora its greatest importance is that the earth becomes self-luminous, that besides the light which is a planet is received from the central body, it shows a capability of sustaining a luminous process proper to itself. There were times when our little craft, driven by wind that was continuous and persistent, shot through the waters like an arrow. Indeed, had we encountered a hidden rock or obstacle, our little vessel would have been crushed into kindling wood. At last, we were conscious that the atmosphere was growing decidedly colder. And a few days later, icebergs were sighted far to the left. My father argued, and correctly, that the winds which filled our sails came from the warm climate within. And the time of the year was certainly most proper for us to make our dash for the outside world and attempt to scud our fishing vessel through the open channels of the frozen zone which surrounds the polar regions. We were soon amid the ice packs, and they grew tighter, and our little craft got through the narrow channels and escaped being crushed. I'll never know. My dad was an expert boatsman. The compass behaved in the same drunken and unreliable fashion in passing over the southern curve or edge of the earth's shell as it had done before on our inbound trip from the northern entrance. It gyrated, dipped, and seemed like a thing that was possessed. One day, I was lazily looking over the side of the boat into the clear waters, and my father shouted, "Breakers ahead!" Looking up, I saw through a lifting mist a white object that towered several hundred feet high, completely shutting off our advance. We lowered sail immediately, and none too soon, for in a moment we found ourselves wedged between two monstrous icebergs. Each was crowding and grinding against its fellow mountain of ice. They were like two gods of war contending for supremacy. We were greatly alarmed. Indeed, we were between the lines of a battle royal. The spawner the grinding ice was like the continued volleys of artillery. Blocks of ice larger than a house were frequently lifted up 100 feet by the mighty force of lateral pressure, and they would shudder and rock to and fro for a few seconds and then come crashing down with a deafening roar and disappear in the foaming waters. Thus, for more than 2 hours, the contest of the icy giants continued. It seemed as if the end for our journey had come. The ice pressure was terrific, and while we were not caught in the dangerous part of the jam and were safe for the time being, yet the heaving and rending of tons of ice as it fell splashing here and there into the watery depths filled us with a shaking fear. And finally, to our great joy, the grinding of the ice ceased, and within a few hours the great masses slowly divided, and if as an act of providence had been performed for us, right before us lay an open channel. Should we venture our little fishing craft into this opening? If the pressure came on again, our little boat, as well ourselves, would be crushed into nothingness. When we decided to take the chance, and accordingly hoisted our sail to a favorable breeze, and soon we started out like a racehorse, running the gamut of this unknown narrow channel over to the open water. And for the next 45 days, our time was employed in dodging icebergs and hunting channels. Indeed, we had not been favored with a strong south wind and a small boat. I doubt if this story could have ever been given to the world. They were favored with a strong south wind. At last, there came a morning when my father said, "My son, I think we are to see home. I think we're going to make it. We're almost through the ice. See, yonder, the open water lies before us." However, there were a few icebergs that floated far northward into the open water still ahead of us, on either side, stretching away for many miles, directly in front of us, and by the compass, which we had now righted itself due north, there was an open sea. What a wonderful story we have to tell the people of Stockholm, continued my father, while a look of pardonable elation lighted up his honest face. And think of the gold nuggets stowed away in the hole. My dear son, we will never want through the kindness of our friends of the inward earth. I spoke kind words to my father, not alone for his fortitude and endurance, but also for his courageous and daring as a discoverer, and for having made the voyage that now promised a successful end. I was elated. I was so grateful that we had gathered the wealth of gold that we were carrying home. I couldn't wait to see my family. While congratulating ourselves on the goodly supply of provisions and water that we still had on hand, and on the dangers that we had escaped, we were startled by hearing a most terrific explosion caused by the tearing apart of a huge mountain of ice. It was a deafening roar, like the firing of 1,000 cannon. We were sailing at the time with great speed and happened to be near a monstrous iceberg, which to all appearance was an immovable as a rock hound island. It seemed, however, that the iceberg had split and was breaking apart, whereupon the balance of the monster along which we were sailing was destroyed and it began dipping from us. My father quickly anticipated the danger before I realized its awful possibilities. The iceberg extended down into the water many hundreds of feet, and as it tipped over, the portion coming up out of the water caught our fishing craft like a lever and threw it into the air as it had been a football. Our boat fell back on the iceberg. that by this time had changed the side next to us for the top. My father was still in the boat. I had been thrown out upon the iceberg, but he became entangled in the rigging while I was thrown some 20 feet away. I quickly scrambled to my feet and shouted to my father, who answered, "All is well, my son." Just then, a realization dawned upon me. Horror upon horror. The blood that ran in my veins literally froze. The iceberg was still in motion, and its great weight and force in topping over would cause it to submerge temporarily. I fully realized that a sucking whirlpool would be produced amid the whirls of water on every side and would rush into the depression and all their fury like white fanged wolves eager for a human prey, and there set our boat right in the middle of this situation. In this supreme moment of mental anguish, I remember glancing at our little boat, which was lying on its side, and wondered if it could possibly right itself and if my father could escape. Was this the end of our struggles and adventures? Was this sure death? All these questions flashed through my mind in the fraction of a second. Why did we dare to leave the safety we had an offer to stay where we could have been safe and lived in a paradise? And yet a moment later, I was engaged in a life and death struggle. The ponderous monolith of ice sank below the surface, and the frigid waters gurgled around me in frenzied anger. I was in a whirlwind saucer with the waters pouring in on every side, and then I lost consciousness. When I partially recovered my senses and roused from the swoon of a half drowned man, I found myself wet, stiff, and certainly almost frozen, lying on the iceberg. There was no sign of my father or our little fishing boat. The monster berg had recovered itself, and with its new balance, lifted its head perhaps 50 feet above the waves. The top of this island of ice was a plateau, perhaps a half an acre in extent. Oh, how I loved my father so well. I was so grief-stricken at the awfulness of his death. I wailed at the fate that I, too, had not been permitted to sleep with him in the depths of the ocean. Finally, I climbed to my feet and looked about me. The purple domed sky above, the shoreless green ocean beneath, and only an occasional iceberg was discernible. My heart sank in hopeless despair. I cautiously picked my way across the berg toward the other side, hoping that our fishing craft had been hurled in that direction and had righted itself. Dad, I think it possible that my father still lived. It was but a small ray of hope that flamed up into my heart, but the anticipation warmed my blood in my veins and started it rushing like some rare stimulant through every fiber of my body. I crept close to the precipitous side of the iceberg and peered far down, hoping that I made a circle of the berg, scanning every foot of the way, and thus I kept going around and around. One part of my brain was certain that it coming manacle, while the other part, I believe, and due to this day, was perfectly rational. How, I do not know. I was conscious of having made the circuit a dozen times, and while one part of my intelligence knew, and all reason, that there was not a vestige of hope, yet some strange, fascinating thing bewitched and compelled me to beguile myself with expectation. The other part of my brain seemed to tell me that while there was no possibility of my father yet being alive, yet if I quit making the circles pilgrimage, if I pause for a single moment, it would be acknowledgement of defeat. And should I do this, I felt that I should go mad. Thus, hour after hour, I walked around and around, afraid to stop and to rest, yet physically powerless to continue much longer. Oh, horror of horrors, to be cast away in this wide expanse of water, far from my home, without food or drink, and only a treacherous iceberg for the abiding place. My heart sank within me, and all semblance of hope was fading in black despair. But then, the hand of a deliverer was extended, and the death-like stillness of a solitude rapidly became unbearable, was suddenly broken by the firing of a signal gun. I looked up, and in startled amazement, when I saw less than a half a mile away a rolling vessel bearing down toward me with her sail full set. Evidently, my continued activity on the iceberg had attracted their attention. On drawing near, they put out a boat, and descending cautiously to the water's edge, I was rescued, and a little later, lifted on board the whaling ship. I found out that it was a Scotch whaler, the Arlington. She had cleared from Dundee in September of that year and started immediately for the Antarctic in search of whales. The captain, Angus McPherson, seemed kindly disposed, but in matters of discipline, as I soon learned, possessed an iron will. When I attempted to tell him that I'd come from the inside of the earth and that my father had been killed in a collision with an iceberg, the captain and mate looked at each other, shook their heads, and insisted on my being put in the bunk under strict surveillance of the ship's physician. I was very weak from want of food. I had not slept in many hours. However, after a day's rest, I got up one morning and dressed myself without asking permission of the physician or anyone else. I told them that I was as sane as anyone on board. The captain sent for me and again questioned me concerning where that I had come from and how that I came to be along on an iceberg in the far-off Antarctic Ocean. I replied that I had just come from the inside of the earth and proceeded to tell him how my father, myself, had gone in an opening in the north and stayed for 2 years inside with a strange and large people, and that we had came out by the way of the south and the prevailing winds into the pole country. Whereupon I was put in irons, and I afterward heard the captain tell the mate that I was as crazy as a bunny rabbit, and that I must remain in confinement until I was rational enough to give a truthful account of myself. Finally, after much pleading and many promises, I was released from irons. I then and there decided to invent some story that would satisfy the captain. And never again would I ever refer to my trip to the land of the Smoky God. Well, at least until I was among my friends and family. Within a fortnight, I was permitted to go about and take my place as one of the seamen. A little later, the captain asked me for an explanation. I told him that my experience had been so horrible and that I was so fearful of my memory, and begged him to permit me to leave the question unanswered until sometime in the future. "I think you're recovering considerably," said the captain, "but you are not yet sane enough by a good deal. Permit me to do such work as you may assign," I replied. "And if it does not compensate you sufficiently, I will pay you immediately after I reach Stockholm to the last penny," and thus the matter was rested. On finally reaching Stockholm, as I have already related, I found that my good mother had gone to her grave, to her reward, more than a year before that I had arrived in Stockholm. The treachery of a relative landed me in a madhouse when I remained for 28 years, seemingly unended years, but still later, after my release, I returned to life as a fisherman, following it seditiously for 27 years, and then how I came to America and finally to Los Angeles, California. But all this can be of little interest to the reader indeed. It seems to me the climax of my wonderful travels and strange adventures was reached when the Scotch whaling vessel took me from an iceberg in the Arctic Ocean. I had been betrayed by my uncle. All of the land that had been my mother's in her possession had been given to me on my return until I told the story, and then I was immediately looked on with suspicion of being crazy and spending too much time in the far north. I was put in an insane asylum, and for 28 years I remained a prisoner in this asylum for telling my friends and my loved ones the truth that I've sworn to and affirmed that I am and was in a place called the Smoky God. And there I met wonderful friends, and how I wish I'd have stayed. I could have saved my father's life, and I would have been happy. I would have spent 28 years in a mental institution where I paid for the truth. Having in my own underway devoted years to these problems, I am well acquainted with the accepted definitions of gravity, as well as the cause of the magnetic needle's attraction. And I am proud to say that it is my firm belief that the magnetic needle is influenced solely by electrical currents which completely envelop the earth like a garment. And in these electrical currents, in an endless circuit path out of the southern end of the earth's cylindrical opening, diffusing and spreading themselves over all the outside surface, and rushing madly on in their course toward, again, the North Pole. And while these currents seemingly dash off into space at the Earth's curvable edge, yet they drop again to the inside surface and continue their way southward along the inside of the Earth's crust toward the opening of the so-called South Pole. As to gravity, no one knows what it is, because it has been determined whether it is atmospheric pressure that causes the alpha to fall, or whether 150 miles below the surface of the Earth, supposedly one half way through the Earth's crust, there exists some powerful lodestone attraction that draws it, and therefore whether the alpha, when it leaves the limb of the tree, is drawn or impaled downward to the nearest point of resistance is unknown to the students of physics. Sir James Ross claimed to have discovered the magnetic pole at about 74 degrees latitude. And this is wrong. The magnetic pole is exactly one-half the distance through the Earth's crust. Thus, if the Earth's crust is 300 miles in thickness, which is the distance I estimated to be, then the magnetic pole is undoubtedly 150 miles below the surface of the Earth. It matters not where the test is made. And at this particular point, 150 miles below the surface, gravity ceases and becomes neutralized. And when we pass beyond that point on toward the inside surface of the Earth, a reverse attraction geometrically increases in power until the other 150 miles of distance is traversed, which would bring us out on the inside of the Earth. Thus, if a hole was bored down through the Earth's crust at London, Paris, or New York, or Chicago, or Los Angeles, for that matter, a distance of 300 miles, it would connect the two surfaces. While the inertia and momentum of a weight dropped from the outside surface would carry it far past the magnetic center. Yet before reaching the inside surface of the Earth, it would gradually diminish in speed, and after passing the halfway point, finally pause and immediately fall back toward the outside surface and continue thus to oscillate like the swinging of a pendulum with the power removed until it would finally rest at the magnetic center or at the peculiar point exactly one half the distance between the outside surface and the inside surface of the Earth. The gyration of the Earth is its daily act of whirling around in its spiral rotation at a rate greater than 1,000 miles every hour, or about 17 miles per second. Makes it a vast electro-generating body and like a huge machine of a superintelligence that designed this mighty prototype, which at best is an imitation of nature's original with the theory of gravity. There's things that we need to learn, and the valleys of this inner Atlantis continent bordering the upper waters of the farthest north are in season covered with the most magnificent and luxuriant of flowers. Not hundreds and thousands, but millions of acres, from which the pollen of blossoms are carried far away in every direction by the Earth's spiral gyrations and the agitation of the winds resulting therefrom. And it is these blossoms of pollen from the vast foreign meadows within that produce the colored snows of the Arctic regions that have so mystified the northern explorers. The same ideal is beyond question that this new land within is the home and the cradle of the human race. And viewed from the standpoint of the discoveries made by me and my father, and my father giving his life, and me spending so much time being looked at as someone crazy and out of his mind, we must of necessity have a most important bearing on all physical, paleontological, archaeological, and mythological theories of antiquity. The same ideal of going back to the land of mystery, to the very beginning, to the origin of man, is also found in many of the traditions of the early terrestrial regions of the gods, heroes, and man. From the historical fragments, fully verified by the historical records taken from the more recent excavations, as well as traditions of the Northern American Indians, who swear that they know that man lives in the inner Earth. I, too, am a witness of my fellow American Indians, and I know it is now 1 hour past midnight. The new year of 1908 is here, and this is the third day thereof, and having at least finished the record of my strange travels and adventures I wish given to the world, I am ready and even longing for the peaceful rest which I am sure will follow life's trials. I am old in years and ripe both with adventures and sorrows, yet rich with many new friends that I have cemented to me in my struggles to at least lead a just and upright life. Like a story that is well nigh told, my life is ebbing away, and the presentiment is strong within me that I shall not live to see the rising of another sun. Thus do I conclude my message, Olaf Jansen. I swear under oath that my story is true, and I hope someday that it's proven to be so. I will perhaps be long gone, but it would be worth the memory of my father and may his soul rest in peace. And may you that have read my story pray for insight that there is a Garden of Eden inside this earth that man was driven from never to return until the appointed time. Take care, my dear friends, and my love to you. Olaf Jansen. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a strange story. Told